LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Listen without limits. Unchain your brain. Change your thinking. Change your life. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host, Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Keith Preston. In a follow-up to part one discussing his book Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire, Keith focuses on reimagining current political, social, cultural, and economic paradigms towards a future in which we at last begin to learn from past mistakes. On a shrinking planet riven by warring ideologies and intractable conflicts, is it time to finally make way for truly decentralized systems, voluntary societies, and a world where those who will simply never agree simply go their separate ways? Hello and welcome, Keith, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Good to be back.
Okay, Keith, now last time, just a few weeks ago, you and I spoke about a new collection of writings that you published, Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire. For listeners who are not up to speed or maybe just joining us here for the first time, I'd refer them back to that interview, both for biographical information about yourself and also, of course, to get up to speed with our discussion. What I want to do today is kind of drop in at the deep end of where we left off last time, more or less. I can't exactly recall where we got up to, but we're very much talking about society and culture at large and the political, social, economic, environmental, all the problems facing us globally at the minute. And anarchism as a as a sort of stripe of political thinking, as a sort of an approach to social and political organization with many different variations. And we discussed a few of those. So I want to drop in today with some of the particular issues facing nations such as yours, my own, Europe, most of the West, or countries that aspire to be Western in style, but also affecting, you know, the Eastern Bloc and Asia. And, you know, there's variations of these problems all over the world. And then start to think about what different ways of social, cultural, and political organization along some of the lines that you set out in your book could help us with this, or how things might look differently. Because one of the key themes I think we had last time we drew out was a paucity of imagination when it comes to the everyday Joe. They're so steeped in whatever political system they've grown up in, whatever that happens to be. And even now with the internet and, you know, spread of information globally, there's a quite narrow, very prescribed range of possibilities about societal organization that people just can't see beyond that. I think that's one of the things that certainly if anyone read your book, they start to see that, oh, actually there is a different way of doing things. It doesn't have to be, you know, more of the same.
Well, I think that's very true. The political debate that we see in mainstream discourse actually takes place within a fairly narrow set of parameters. Years ago, Noam Chomsky, you know, the leading left-wing intellectual, created a concept that he labeled manufacturing consent. And he argued that the function of the institutions that are responsible for disseminating ideas, whether it's the media, whether it's the educational system, whether it's all of the different industries that we might call ideas industries, that is, you know, everything from advertising and marketing to law to even some business management oriented fields, all of these disciplines are about manufacturing consent. And that is manufacturing consent so that people naturally agree with what those in power want them to agree with. That is, people are conditioned from their earliest formative years in their lives to believe that the system that we have is the best possible system. And while there may be things wrong with it, these are only minor problems that can be corrected. And all you have to do is just in the case of societies like we're familiar with, all you have to do is vote harder next time and be a good citizen and pay taxes and all of the things that you're expected to do as a matter of civic obligation. And the effect of that is that alternative points of view are removed from the realm of public discourse. And it's not that there's some kind of conspiracy going on. It's not that there are people sitting in a room somewhere smoking cigars saying, hey, how can we brainwash the public into believing what we want them to believe? Rather, it's a filtering process. Most people who hold positions of leadership and power are, some may be cynical opportunists who just take advantage of whatever circumstances present themselves in the way that serves their own self-interest. There's certainly a lot of that. And then there's others, many others, who simply believe that their way is the right way because it's just what they know. And that has a trickle-down effect. For instance, when we look at the media and we see that alternative points of view are not presented in the media, it's not that media executives are necessarily saying, well, we don't want this point of view presented. We don't want this point of view presented. It's simply that they just don't think alternative points of view are legitimate. I mean, there may be conscious censorship or conscious decisions made to ignore certain issues or topics at time, but just as often, it's the perception that the realm of legitimate opinion is what upholds the system. And then when people are recruited into media or into academia or into government or into professions and other institutions, there's a similar filtering process. Sometimes there's actual discrimination against people who hold alternative points of view. For example, Professor Norman Finkelstein was denied tenure at DePaul University, clearly because of his support for the Palestinian struggle and not because of any incompetence on his part as a scholar. He's a highly competent scholar. Right? That's an example of direct censorship or repression or perhaps the use of economic and professional sanctions to exclude a certain point of view. But just as likely, the way the system works is that it's self-selecting. That is, people who believe in the system are the ones drawn towards the system's institutions, and they become the ones who ultimately start disseminating information and making decisions and things of that nature. And then it's a cyclical process. The system has a way of reproducing itself. So that's why we see institutions operating in the way that they are. Like for institutions to function, whether it's government, whether it's the economic system, whether it's organized religion or something like that, two basic things have to happen. First, there has to be a high level of acquiescence. That is, people simply go along with what they're familiar with or what is established to get along. You don't question the system. You may not like aspects of the system. You may not like any parts of the system, but you simply go along to get along. A lot of people do that. And then there's also acclimation, and that is people actually believe in whatever system they're a part of, and they salute leaders as figures to be revered, or they praise institutions for being, the apex of human civilizational achievement. But it's when these two things are withdrawn that systems collapse or change. When more and more people withdraw their acquiescence, or when acclimation ends, then that's when you start to see change happening. An illustration would be when the vast communist expanse in Eurasia collapsed in the late 80s and early 90s, the Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact, the Yugoslav Federation. And we're talking about what amounted to 30 or so nations that were under that system. And, for better or worse, for whatever reason, that system collapsed. And outside of the former Yugoslavia, mostly nonviolently, and it collapsed in large part because large numbers of people simply withdrew acquiescence. They just refused to cooperate with this particular system. They just said, no, we're just going to do something else. And there was a withdrawal of acclimation. A classic example there from the illustration I'm giving is when that video of the final speech by Nicolae Ceausescu in Romania, where all of a sudden the crowd starts booing him and he's taken aback by this. He has this look of shock or surprise, like he's never experienced that before. Like, what are you talking about? You don't boo me. But that was with the withdrawal of acclamation. He was expecting praise from the crowd. And what I'm describing here is trans ideological. It could be what I'm not talking about some kind of comparison between communism and capitalism or democracy and illiberalism or something like that. This is true of any kind of system.
Well, a lot of people, almost forget. I mean, never mind those of us who lived through the collapse of the Soviet Union, but a lot of people sort of memory hold that as, and that was a colossal change in the world political, social, economic system. So there's change is possible for all the reasons you just laid out. Some of what you described reminds me of the Jacobins, back in France. Centuries ago, and how they deranged society only so far to the point where the society just broke, and and they were ousted, almost literally overnight. So these things do happen. One of the other things that was interesting about maybe this it informs some of the thinking or non-thinking about what happened with the Soviet Union. Is that what it led to was kind of a resurgent, ultimately a resurgent Russia, and leading to the Russia that we see today, for better or worse. See what I mean? Russian nationalists would certainly see that as a positive change. They're probably equally in dismay at what was happening under the Soviet system. But of course, Francis Fukuyama's ridiculous end of history proposition was also shown to be emperor's new clothes, really, at that point as well. The neocon hegemony, suddenly that wasn't a guarantee to just roll on happily into the 21st century and beyond. So there's ways of perceiving these things that, oh yes, colossal change can happen, but we don't like that, or so even though it happened, it's not possible again in the future. So we either won't talk about it or we'll spin it differently somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's interesting because in the period, I was just talking about the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the vast communist expanse in Eurasia. But after that, we entered this period of about 30 years, the 90s, the 2000s, and at least most of the 2010s, where this Fukuyama type of paradigm was largely dominant. And in fact, if you read a lot of my work, the book that you're currently discussing that was recently published by Black Front Press, and also my past books, as well as essays that are available online through attackthesystem.com and other places, most of my published work was written during the era of what I call the six peaks. All right, that was peak globalization, peak neoconism, peak neoliberalism, peak unipolarity, peak democratism, and peak totalitarian humanism. And that is what I mean by those things is okay, peak unipolarity, those were the years, those 3 decades or so were the years of unquestioned American unipolar hegemony. That was the period of peak globalization, when globalization and the global economy were at their apex and globalization was spreading throughout the world. Peak neoliberalism, accompanying globalization was the neoliberal economic paradigm that came to be dominant. Peak neoconism or neoconservatism, that was the foreign policy paradigm put forth by the United States in the 90s, 2000s under people like well, under figures like Bill Clinton and George Bush, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. This idea of American imperialism ostensibly for the purpose of democratizing the world, but it's really just about maintaining full spectrum dominance. Right. And then there's peak democratism. This was the era in which a record number of states were quote unquote liberal democracies, as that concept is defined in the Western world. And it was also the era of peak totalitarian humanism. And that's largely just my term for what is commonly called political correctness or wokeness or wokeism or social justice warriorism. These different terms have been in vogue at time to describe this phenomena. And all of these things sort of converged. And I think they reached their apex probably around the year 2020, about the time that the pandemic was going on. But after that 30-year period, in recent years, we started to see a recession of the six peaks that I just talked about. Obviously, American unipolarity is being challenged with the rise of China as a peer economic power, the rise of the European Union as a peer economic power, the rise of Russia as a peer military power, as evidenced by the war in Ukraine that started in 2022. So we see peak unipolarity receding now. We're moving towards multipolarity. We can debate how far towards multipolarity we've actually gone, but multipolarity is here to some degree. There's also been the recession of globalization, and that was brought about in part by the pandemic and all of the disruptions of supply chains and things like that that happened during the pandemic that caused more nations to look inward. And many countries are talking about trying to strengthen their own domestic economy and focus less on international trade. Doesn't mean globalization is going away, but there has been a reduced focus on that, and the spread of globalization, I think, has receded somewhat. There's also peak neoliberalism. More and more of the ideology of neoliberalism as an economic framework is being challenged by the left and right. There's a renewed interest in things like economic nationalism. There's a renewed interest in populism. There's a renewed interest in socialism. So these kinds of anti-capitalist or at least anti-neoliberal ideologies are starting to become popular once again. Obviously, there's been a recession of neoconservatism as a foreign policy paradigm. That doesn't mean that neocons don't have influence anymore or others with neocon-like views, but it's widely considered that the neocon paradigm that was at its peak during, say, the George W. Bush era has been a gross failure, as we've seen with the American losses in Afghanistan and in Iraq. The Americans lost those wars hands down, and that's how that pretty much discredits the neocon paradigm. And that's not the only thing, but we see that paradigm retreating. And then, of course, there's democratism. Probably in the late 2010s, there was a record number of countries that were considered full liberal democracies by international observers. And that has started to retreat. There are more and more countries that are now considered autocracies, or another term that's commonly used in political science is anocracy, which is sort of a hybrid system where there's a bit of democracy and a bit of autocracy. A good example like that would probably be a system like Turkey. Turkey is really just an autocracy under Erdogan's leadership, but it still functions as a formal democracy. Another country that's very much gone in that direction, but not as severely, would be Hungary. To some degree, Putin's Russia constitutes this kind of system, a sort of anocracy, an autocratic democracy, or democratic autocracy, or illiberal democracy. And we see more movements and philosophies and leaders of this type developing in different parts of the world, all over the place. Whether it's Bolsonaro in Argentina, I mean, in Brazil, or the former Duterte government in the Philippines that's now been overturned. Plenty of examples of this worldwide. Now, What this resembles is the world of 1900. If we look at the world of 1900, we see many, many, many fascinating parallels with that time period and our time period. We go back in time 125 years, what we see is that that was the era of peak industrialization. The Industrial Revolution was really at its peak in 1900. Just like right now, we see digital capitalism, the digital revolution spreading everywhere and taking over modern life and society and institutions. There was also very, very rapid social and cultural change, as there is now. And along with that, a great deal of social and cultural and economic dislocation. For instance, back then, we saw the gap between rich and poor widen severely. And we're seeing a repeat of that. For instance, in the United States at the present time, the wealth gap between rich and poor is the widest it's been since before the Great Depression, about 100 years ago, back in the 1920s. We see the rise of opposition movements in response to these conditions. Just like in the late 19th century, early 20th century, we saw the rise of socialism and communism and classical anarchism. Also, we saw authoritarian nationalism from the right and the conservative revolution and the counter-revolutionaries. We see parallels to that in today's world as well. We start to see that left-wing radicalism, right-wing radicalism, these things are also making a comeback, because the conditions are very similar. In the late 19th century, we had a multipolar world. We had, the British Empire was the largest player on the field, but you also had the French Empire, you had the other European colonial empires of the era, you had the Russian Empire, the Ottomans. The United States was a rising continental power in the Western Hemisphere. You had the rise of Japan in East Asia. And we see analogous things to that today. America today is kind of what the British Empire was in 1900. That is the biggest player, but not the only player, and a player that's in a state of decline. In some ways, the Chinese today may be analogous to the French 125 years ago, because just like the French 125 years ago, now we see the Chinese creating these de facto colonies for themselves in the global south, like in Africa, even if it's a different model of colonialism. I call it debt colonialism as opposed to military colonialism, but it's still a type of neo-colonialism, even if it assumes a different form. And then we also see the rising powers around the world. We see Russia reasserting itself. We also see new rising powers like India, like Turkey, with like Saudi Arabia, like Indonesia. All of these places are becoming more and more important to the world economy and the world order. And that's what we were seeing in the year 1900. And likewise, we see the kind of geopolitical rivalries intensifying, the stuff that led up to World War I. We see the rising tensions between the Eastern Bloc and the Western Bloc, between the UK and EU and USA on one hand, and the BRICS countries on the other hand. So it's very, very, very similar conditions. And many of the same things have emerged in response to all of this. And much of my work to date, the stuff that's available online or through my books, wasn't really about analyzing this process as it unfolded. And I think most of my political analysis and overall set of predictions were largely correct. As I've developed all of that over the past 25 years or so, it's possible to quibble with some of the details, and there's a few things where I think I probably missed the boat. But for the most part, I think my overall analytical framework was correct. However, it's interesting to consider that we're now moving into a transitional period. We're moving into a world that's where the six peaks that I described earlier, that much of my work to date is about, critiquing and analyzing. A lot of that is starting to fade now, and we're trying to we're starting to move into a world that is more multipolar, where there's a pushback from, if you want to call it, the right reaction, conservatism, nationalism, something of that type. Like I predicted, I think that the neocon paradigm would fail. And the post 9/11 war certainly did fail. I predicted the decline of US power and unipolarity. That's obviously happening, along with the rise of the BRICS and multipolarity. And I also saw the class and cultural divisions emerge that we see today. And I also, spent a lot of time critiquing political correctness, woke totalitarian humanism, I call it. And I thought there would eventually be a right-wing backlash against that, and also increased state repression. We do see increased state repression in certain ways. I think it's a little different in England and on the European continent than it is in America. Well, I guess it depends on the country, but I see these stories about people getting arrested for tweets and that kind of stuff, and Facebook posts in England in a way that you probably wouldn't see in America. At least there has been some of that. There has been a little bit of that, but not quite on the level that I've seen in some other countries. However, we do see increased state repression in other ways. For example, in particular, efforts to repress criticism of the U.S. relationship with the state of Israel. Certainly seen a rise of state repression there. So, that's more or less where the world is today. The six peaks were dominant for about a 30-year period, more or less, and now we're starting to see a transition towards something else.
Well, that's a very comprehensive events and trends timeline that you've set out there. And the first thing that springs to mind is how it highlights, in many ways, the cyclical nature of history. Again, flying in the face of Fukuyama's ridiculous end of history idea that, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And that fundamentally, as a culture or a society, globally or otherwise, that we keep doing the same things again. But there's also certain, developments, I would say, in those cycles. It's not exactly the same each time. It's just a familiar framework. One of the things, is, of course, as you've been mentioning, is not only a pushback against some of those your six peak trends that were so dominant for a while, but also a counter action, a counter narrative. Or reaction, however you want to put it, from establishment players to try and tone down the significance of some of these changes. For example, two of the biggest ones that drew global attention that I've discussed quite extensively were, first of all, the election of Donald Trump. Not once now, but twice. What that all that meant in terms of like the macro picture of American society and culture, and then also Brexit. In case anyone has been hiding under a rock for the last 20 years, the United Kingdom's exit, voted for by the populace, their exit from the European Union, no longer being part of that political bloc. And at the time, each of those events, that was almost like people were in denial about the fact, these things, to some people's way of looking at the world, simply could not happen or could not be allowed to happen. And when they did, it was so telling to see the cognitive dissonance. And that continues to this day. And then, as you mentioned, we had perhaps the peak six phenomena in 2020. That, as you say, was the pandemic period. And then the response to all of that, which I think was, whatever you think about the origin and nature of that, I think that was certainly exploited, or there was attempts to exploit what was happening there to double down on, repression and control and what have you. And I think that at the minute, the phenomena that you mentioned under the banner of political correctness or culture wars or wokeism, whatever you like to call it, those are a couple of things to my mind. One is a sort of conscious attempt to throw things like the trans agenda and this sort of similar nonsense into the collective sort of psychological mix as a distraction, sort of poison the well, get people thinking about this nonsense that affects almost no one, in lieu of actually looking at what's going on. But in the wider and deeper panorama, but also it's a manifestation in a way, the way that individuals and societies buy into this, it's a manifestation of collective derangement. We would rather talk about access to toilets or men and women's sports, then we would look at what the hell the future of the species is going forward and what can be done about our predicament.
Yeah, well, my take on a lot of these culture war issues that you were referring to is to look at it within an institutional context. For instance, rather, there whether one likes, say, transgender people or not, or whether one likes immigration or not, or likes abortion or not, or likes, in the case of the United States, likes guns or not, or whether somebody, whatever one's views about the origin and of the COVID pandemic and the responses with, lockdown and mask mandates or whatever one thinks about it, vaccines. All of these are important topics. I'm not saying none of these are important topics. But what I'm mostly interested in is the way that institutions use all sorts of narratives related to these kinds of topics as a means of either institutional control or self-legitimation, or in some cases, hopefully for its own purpose, part, whether for divide and conquer or whatever. As an illustration, I'm going to talk about the United States because I know the United States better than England, but because I am American, but if you look at the history of the United States and its electoral system, what we typically see is that, like you were saying earlier, things tend to go in cycles. And with our party system, we have our two-party system. Typically, one party will be dominant for about a 40-year period, and then another party will be dominant for the 40-year period. And then there'll be another 40 years where the cycle repeats itself. And I've looked at the history of all this, and we can trace this history fairly consistently since at least the late 19th century, arguably going back to the beginning of the United States in the late 18th, early 19th century. And starting around 1968, when Richard Nixon was elected president, up until about 2008, for that 40-year period, the Republicans were the dominant party in the United States. And the Republicans' paradigm was, their ideological paradigm was hawkishness on foreign policy. We're talking about Ronald Reagan and people like that. This kind of neoliberal supply-side economics approach to economic policy. So anti-Keynesianism, anti-social democratic, anti-labor, anti-populism, this kind of free market, Freedmanite, Mount Pelerin Society approach to economics. And also socio-cultural conservatism of, meaning endorse, cultivating the religious traditionalist or other types of social and cultural conservatives of different types. And that paradigm was largely dominant in the United States politically for about 40 years. Not to say it didn't have opponents or critics or anything like that. But the issue is that all states, all ruling classes have to have a self-legitimating ideological superstructure, which is the Marxist term for it. But the idea that the state maintains an ideology, the ruling class maintains an ideology that says our system is correct, our system is just, our system is moral, virtuous, ethical, or at least the best there is, even if it's imperfect in various ways. And then the details are usually fleshed out by all of these other things, like I was just describing. So this kind of, in America, it's called fusionism, but this kind of fusionist conservatism was dominant from the late, more or less from the late 60s up through 2008. Now, what happened in 2008 is that the right wing of the ruling class that the Republican Party represents was largely seen as discredited because of the failures of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, because of the economic crisis of 2008, because of the unpopularity of the Bush Jr. administration by that point. That created an opening for the another wing of the ruling class, which is the liberal wing. Like in America, the Sun Belt wing, which tends to be represented by the Republican Party, that's the national industrial bourgeoisie. That's like the traditional industrial elites. Whereas the northeastern part of the nation, that wing of the ruling class is the Eastern establishment or the more liberal wing. At present, they tend to back the Democrats and have for quite a while. And that tends to be more like finance capital. So the Democrats are finance capital, the Republicans are industrial capital. And then over time, as digital capitalism has become a thing, and new finance capital like hedge funds and that kind of stuff have become a thing, they initially aligned themselves with the liberal wing of the ruling class. Now there's been a split. The upper levels of new capital, like these Elon Musk type characters and BlackRock type characters, a lot of that has gone over to the Republicans. But then the more lower to middle levels of new capital, like a lot of your Silicon Valley tech entrepreneurs, are still with the Democrats. So that's just kind of the backstory to what I'm talking here about here. But in 2008, an opening was created for the liberal wing of the ruling class to make a comeback, representing finance capital and new capitalism. And what they did was they jettisoned the fusionist ideology that had dominated the Republican Party since the 1960s. And they replaced it with this ideology that I have referred to as totalitarian humanism. And if you want to know what my analysis of all that is, of woke, of political correctness, I have a lengthy video. It's on the attacktheSystem.com website under the banner of "Can Anyone Define Wokeness?" It's also on YouTube. It's a video on YouTube. And I'm not going to go into all the details of it here, but suffice to say that this particular wing of the ruling class that I'm talking about now adopted this paradigm of political correctness, wokeism, social justice warriorism, totalitarian humanism, and that has its roots in a lot of different intellectual and pre and cultural and political currents that predate this, but they adopted this as its ideological superstructure. And that's why, when all of this stuff was at its peak, we saw companies like BlackRock promoting ESG. We saw companies like Bank of America and Amazon, all of these very elite tech companies and financial companies. We saw them putting Black Lives Matter banners on their websites and that kind of stuff. That was when totalitarian humanism was at its peak. And that overlaps with the COVID policies. You had a lot of people from that end of the ruling class or that end of the political spectrum advocating what amounted to a scorched earth policy when it comes to dealing with COVID. The idea, well, if one person gets COVID, that's too much. We've got to, I was actually fairly moderate in my views on COVID. I didn't think it was some big conspiracy that was deliberately created to justify lockdowns and repression or something like that. But I do think that the ruling classes of many nations used it as a pretext, exploited the situation, as you were saying earlier, for things like going on a looting spree, which is what happened in the United States with a lot of the so-called bailouts of businesses and financial institutions that went on. And also, I think it was used as a pretext for expanding control over communication, like censorship. Like there was a great deal of, hand-wringing among elite circles about misinformation related to COVID. And, how dare somebody disseminate conspiracy theories about COVID or whatever. So I do think that this element, was converged at the same time. Peak wokeness and the pandemic sort of converged to make that situation what it was. And it was an interesting scenario. It was a I think that particular paradigm reached its apex in 2020, and we've since seen a pushback against that. We've seen in recent years, we've seen more of a pushback from the political right, and from the cultural right, and from social conservatism and nationalism in response to this kind of woke totalitarian humanist cultural paradigm, but also the six peaks that I discussed earlier on a more general level. Now, that doesn't mean that I personally agree with much of what you see in the right-wing pushback against some of these things. Much of that, I think, is problematic in other ways, but it is part of the pattern that's unfolding.
Well, perhaps if we could move to how some of the problems that we're facing might appear different, be imagined differently, be dealt with differently under a radically reimagined system of political organized, political, social, cultural organization. That concludes part one of our interview. Part two will be available soon in the subscribers area at legalizefreedom.com.
Legalize freedom. Dot com.